I also am looking forward to the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about the process of the book. I guess I would like to start, of course, by thanking Mary for inviting me to the class, and I want to thank Dana also for inviting me to her class. And there's lots of people here who have come that are not part of your seminar, but I also want to thank you for coming and being here too. You know, I just presented in an undergraduate class on art, EMS class, and I think, you know, I took a certain approach in that class in talking a little bit, and I talked a little bit about my own background, who I am, where I come from, and then I talked a little bit about the journey of the book, and then I showed all the images, you know, and trying to minimize some of the commentary. Mary had said, so I want to do something a little bit like that, but also want to make it a little bit different, what I want to talk about. In part, I think, because it is a graduate seminar. And so I think the way that I want to talk about with you, I understand that you're probably through because you spent 2 weeks on the book. So I think that part of what I want to share with you has to do with the beginning, you know, of the book, which is actually reflected in the first chapters of the book, you know. And kind of the journey of the book and the politics of this project. And it being a graduate seminar, I feel a lot more comfortable throwing out words like, decolonizing, feminist, queer-centered, right? Anti-racist, anti-Eurocentric. The project for me happened in a lot of different ways, and I think one of the most important things that I want to share, that's really a great thing to be able to share about the book, is that deciding to write the book and the way that I wrote it was for me a very political process. It was also a very spiritual process, by the way, but it was a very political process because when I first started to talk about these questions, even among my colleagues, I think that people were really worried. They're like, oh my God, this girl's out here in San Francisco and she's like been like influenced by the New Age and how embarrassing, what is she gonna do, you know? Because I was starting to talk about spirituality and how I thought spirituality was so interesting and hybrid, mixed, and politically oppositional, and really, my allies, my colleague friends, were just silent. I mean, that's, you know, when you say something that's important to you, like I'm an untenured professor, and I decided I'm going to work on this project, and they respond with silence. You think, like, okay, they think I'm an idiot, you know? Or worse, they think that my brain has been destroyed by being, you know, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then you go home and you wonder if your brain has been destroyed, you know, by being in the And so, you know what? It was really, really hard to begin the project. In one way, it wasn't. In one way, it was a totally spontaneous, you know, as I say in the beginning of the book, it was like a spontaneous attraction, even though, like a lot of spontaneous attractions, you try to repress it, right? So, as I did say this at the beginning of the other class, I'll repeat the anecdote, so those bear with me who were there. It started, and again, I say this in the beginning of the book, in the intro, the invocations, it started because I was reading an article on gender. It was doing a history of like gender and in the United States. And it was supposed to be really progressive. And it was supposed to have learned the lessons of women of color criticizing white feminism. And so they wanted to talk about the important contributions of women of color. And so she talked about Gloria Sandua's Borderlands. But she didn't talk about one of the most important things in that book, which was her concern with spirituality, la facultad, you know, all of that. That Gloria Sandua talks about as part of the spiritual borderlands. And that's the reason she talked about it as a spiritual borderlands, because people did not want to talk about spirituality in the art world, in the white-dominated or Eurocentric literary world, even the world of women writers, feminist writers, queer activists. You know, there were people doing spirituality, like kinds of New Age spirituality, etc. But in general, especially at the university, Gloria Sandua was in 2 PhD programs, one in Texas and then over in Santa Cruz. And so, you know, she was really dealing with that, wanting to integrate, you know, like her writings about accepting all the parts of yourself. And so she was dealing with that. And that's why she also wanted to come out of the closet spiritually and to say, it's not just psychological, cultural, you know, racial, spiritual borderlands. It's also spiritual borderlands. So anyway, this book, this was Donna Haraway's Simian Cyborgs and Women, I'm talking about in her chapter on gender. Well, the whole book, you know, is about like the importance of science to women and to feminism and how women need to move away from essentialist arguments about what it is to be women and that women need to not be afraid to engage the objective and the scientific. So right after reading that chapter, then I read her discussion of Bodhisattva in the gender chapter, and I realized that she had decided to be quote-unquote kind and do Bodhisattva a favor, and according to her, not embarrass her, by talking about how important spirituality was to Bodhisattva. And I thought, wow, that's like so condescending, you know, to not take her seriously, to not really engage that. And then, like, as I continue thinking about all those things, you know, I think that over time, what became really clear is that people, because of the history of racism, right, and cultural Darwinism, right, biological Darwinism, the idea, you know, that Darwin discovered, according to him, the struggle, you know, among different life forms, and so that the survivors were the fittest. Well, sociologists and then philosophers took that and transferred it in a bad case of interdisciplinarity. Not all interdisciplinarity is a good thing. And in this case, transferred what might have been applicable in describing the development of natural life forms into supposedly describing the historical development and the cultural relationships between different peoples in the world. The whole idea that there are different races and that they're unequal and that some are advanced and some are the tail end. And so are the cultures, right? So that kind of racist cultural evolutionary thinking that some people, you know, are consigned to the tail end and one day will reach the pinnacle of, you know, Western European elite manhood also functioned with assumptions around gender, right? And with assumptions around spirituality. So the idea being that, you know, as in the progress, you know, after the Enlightenment, right, these last two centuries, what we've seen, we all know this is true. Bodhisattva wrote about it, but we know it's true. That in the university and in art galleries, in the world where people have higher education, it is considered that educated people are no longer really spiritual. That, you know, the progress of education should result in atheism, right? And that those who are prone to being religious are either uneducated people, they're rural backwater people versus urban people, and it's a homogenous white culture that's being talked about, or they're people of color, or they're women, or they're especially women of color, right? So Gloria Saldúa, woman of color, writing about spirituality, you know, that's a predictable relationship for racist evolutionary thought. Oh yeah, of course, those people of color, you know, they are spiritual, especially the women, right? So it was very brave, you know, of Gloria Saldúa to take on the issue of spirituality. Because even among progressive people of color, you know, who were busy reading Marx and all the, you know, the developers of Marxist thought, and I know this because I was involved, you know, community and campus activism with people of color. And so even among them, to be spiritual was a sign of mental weakness, of naivete. And again, I'll repeat something I said in the class because it just says it. Like other Latin American thinkers, U.S. Latino activists, like Latin American thinkers, thought of spirituality as cosa de viejos y indios. De viejas y indios. Spirituality is a thing of the broads and of Indians, of women and Indians. In other words, the superstitious, the mentally vulnerable. So all those stereotypes, so it was incredibly brave of her. And it was true. And I really felt, so, you know, I felt that when I read that, you know, that essay on gender, and she was not talking about one of the most important and challenging parts of that book for me, I thought, wow, why is she erasing this, silencing it, you know? And so I complained about it to one of my friends, and she said, well, write about it. I said, I'm not going to write about it, you know? Because I thought, I'm not going there. What do I know about spirituality? I'm not going there. Let somebody else do it. Because I knew that if I wrote about spirituality, especially not coming out of theology, right, and religious studies, either anthropology or sociology, religious studies, I knew that I would probably be torn to shreds. And I was not ready to do that. At least that's what I thought I knew. The very first time I presented Spirit Glyphs, I went to my office. You know, I'm pretty brave. I also said that in the first class. I am pretty brave in general. But I went to my class, I was so pissed off. I presented it to a group of transnational feminists, you know, transnational, meaning we're very open to women of color, to the globe, third world alliances, we are the cutting edge, we led the feminists of color. I thought they were so obnoxious. I thought they were so racist. I thought that they weren't hearing me, and they wanted me to talk about spirituality in the way that they already thought they understood it. And I felt continually silent. I was so frustrated, I went to my office and I cried, then rabia, rage. And I called, I don't know if I called you, Yana, I called Diane for sure. And I told them what happened, and they said, those women don't know what they're talking about, forget it. Don't even think about them, they have no idea what they're talking about. They're not the people that you need to listen to. And that was so true, because by this point, I had already studied, you know, a ton of this artwork. And this is who I was dialoguing. The artists and their artwork. This was like my reading the theorists. This was my doing my research. This, you know, one of the questions Mary asked me to think about is like, so, you know, what is your review of literature? For me, part of the review of literature was not just the published books out there. It was the work. You know, I'm really going into the work, talking to the artists, if I could, and trying to enrich for myself what I thought they were doing. You know, what are they doing? I don't know. That was a huge part of my research, especially because if you ask in a book like this, who are the sources? Who could I go to, you know, that were like a model for how to talk about the spirituality in the work of women of color in a way that wasn't being defensive about, no, and they're not naive and they're not stupid, okay? You know, they know what they're doing. They're not doing this because their grandmothers made them religious and they haven't gotten over it, right? It's like, it's conscious, it's political, and it isn't even necessarily religious. How do you like that? So where was I going to find that kind, you know, of understanding so that I didn't have to keep on reinventing the wheel or explaining myself or worse, defending myself? I found it in the work. I found it in the artists. I found it in the work of African-American scholars that have done a huge amount of work in spirituality and that write for each other because they understand and respect this body of work, you know? They're not writing to an invisible white critic. They're writing to other intellectuals and artists in the African-American community first. So I took that as a model. Who am I writing to first? And honestly, I said to myself, if what I write can be a conversation with the artist who made the work, first and foremost, and to others who actually really care about what this artwork is putting out there, then that's my audience. That's who I want to talk to. And apart from wanting to create an archive, because that was one of the things I wanted to do. So I told you that I began by this challenge. My friends said, so write about it. No, I'm not going to write about it. Spirituality slowly back into my life because I, like so many people, had put a lot of my spirituality into my activism, my political campus activism. So the language of goodness, the language of ethical responsibility, you know, the language of caring for the other, the language that we're interconnected, it went into that, trying to care for the community, for others through my activism. So slowly coming back in, you know, very odd and unusual ways. It was all that I thought was fascinating. I was like, wow, look what they're doing with spirituality. But it was too, like, weird and out there, kind of stuff that I was reading. So how was I supposed to put that into scholarship, right? You know, how is it, forget the institutional religiosities. What about this other new stuff? People who were channeling information from the Pleiades, you know, et cetera. So that was part of it. I was also reading Buddhism. I was reading, you know, different Hindu teachers. I was, you know, just reading a variety of different things. But it was very separated. You know, I had my shelf of all my show-off books, like all the big theorists, and then at the very bottom, hidden, I had like a few of the more spirituality books, and that hit me. That hit me. I kind of like, oh, that's very interesting what you show off about it, what you closet, you know? And so that part, that eventually became a challenge. So that for me to like, you know, the politics of who I am, what I did, had to be reflected by what my bookshelves looked like. You know, they had to show like how it's all mixed up for me, who I really am, what I read, you know, or what I want to read, the things I buy that I haven't read yet, right? So anyway, that process of learning to kind of integrate, eventually I did deal with spirituality, but at the beginning I'm telling you, it was real split for me, you know. I dealt with it because I began by telling myself that, so I'm not going to deal with spirituality, let somebody else deal with it. Interesting, you know, I'm doing it privately, but, you know, I don't have anything to say about it. But what I did is I got more involved in looking at the arts. I realized how the world of Chicano art, Chicano art, was still so sexist. And that a lot of what smart people were saying about the arts, including people of color, including Chicanos, including other U.S. Latinos, who were being very influenced by post-structuralist theory, you know, at that time. This is in the 80s, excuse me, in the 90s, right? So that whole movement, that whole group of people. So what I found is that even Chicanos were putting down the work of Chicana women, you know, who were dealing with indigenous imagery, you know, as being like, oh my God, what a throwback. Like how, like, you know, it was always boring, it's still boring, you know, how naive. I really felt that there was, that there were a lot of things going on in the way that the art world, even our art world, was talking about what was important in art. And I thought that I saw, I was right, this like contradiction that here you have like artists of color who want to like shake up the establishment, criticize it for its racism and Eurocentrism, and yet they were still using that language of evolution, you know, cultural, you know, progress, right? What they did in the 60s, the 60s and 70s is definitely dead, useless, gone. The new generations are naturally doing everything that's better, and I just felt, wow. First of all, I don't buy that progress timeline, number one. It's never helped us. The business, it's not that progress doesn't exist, of course it does, but that idea that everything's old, you know, it's not absolutely now. I mean, that really serves consumerism, right? That just serves to buy something new. And anyway, it's not, to me, it's not really, it wasn't convincing scholarship. And so I was also, I was thinking about how that was part of what was being absorbed, you know, this kind of Eurocentric frame of mind with respect to art history, number one, and that theories that were very interesting, post-structuralist theories about culture and language, and therefore art, were being absorbed by some of the artists and being used against other artists of color in the community, especially women. And I thought, well, that's really twisted. So now we have this thing going on, this culturally Darwinian thing of the really theoretical, conceptual artists versus the old-fashioned artists who are working with indigenous imagery and language. I thought that is like a really interesting contradiction and twist, you know. So I wanted to challenge that, I wanted to examine that, and I wanted to create an art history, you know, a piece of art history, right? I'm not an art historian. What I describe as cultural studies. But I wanted to write to art history and to correct, to open it up and to include an archive of women's work, you know, so that it would be there and it would exist, you know, in a permanent way. And I wanted to be able to discuss why I thought that these women were working with the kinds of images that they were, right, to really challenge the question of progress, to challenge the knee-jerk, right, reaction against the use of the indigenous. And so that led me to really think very carefully about what some of these artists were doing, you know, and how for them, not all of them, but for some of the artists, what they were doing with the indigenous had to do with the fact that the indigenous, and they might have been doing it with the African diaspora, Julian Sangua was very interested in Sambedia, you know, an African diasporic. So it wasn't only the indigenous. But the point is that through the indigenous, which is the example that I'm mainly focusing on, another worldview was being accessed, right? So it was a question of being able to move beyond Eurocentrism by not just criticizing Eurocentrism, but by talking about the existence of two different art histories, which means two different worldviews, which means two different visual languages. And so what they were doing, to I thought, was incredibly interesting and incredibly decolonizing, right? It wasn't just a reaction to Eurocentrism, naming it for what it is, you're excluding this, you just keep on imposing and reasserting values and qualities and movements and styles that have happened in Europe with all the things that are important to you, photographs, a dried flower, you know, coins, when you travel to somewhere, you know, your little treasure surface, right? And for any of us who have relatives, older relatives who are religious, you know, all the holy people there, their candles, your corsage from the prom, or, you know, or the photograph of the living and the dead, those who are far away, those who are here. So, so the way that it was organized, basically, was, again, it happened, it was very organic, you know? It came from the work. I began to see that a lot of people were working with guys of different kinds, right? A lot, and then another chapter had to do with dresses. And this was because I was coming out of a very anti-femmy, anti-prissy stage, you know, where, like, you know, to show that I was a real feminist, I couldn't admit I had once liked lace, you know, and things like that. And so I'm like, okay, this is another one of my closeted things. I thought, maybe if I, like, start, like, posting pictures of dresses on my computer, you know, I'll start to understand dresses more before I actually put a dress back on, you know. And so then I also began to see a lot of work that had to do with dresses, and then I began to think more deeply about dresses and how people had written about how, you know, the first dress is the garment of our skin. You know, people have written about that spiritually from different traditions. And then I began to think about the politics of this outfit, my skin. That means different things. I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, I get people, if I'm dressed like a punk, people say, oh, she built a punk aesthetic. But even if I'm not dressed like a punk, people read me. They think they read me, depending on where I am. And so, like, so the body, too, is a kind of dress, you know? It, too, is a signifying system. That if we take it different places, it means different things, etc. So anyway, it just, and then that allowed me, for example, to connect to the work of self-portraiture, you know, and how some people are working with. What does it mean? Like, Irena's doing amazing work on what does it mean to do a self-portrait. That's not any, I mean, so we think we know, right? Okay, so you make a picture of yourself, and, you know, if you follow, like, Renaissance traditions, if you're a painter, you put some paintbrushes back there, if you're a scholar, you put a bunch of books, if you're rich, you put a few minks, right? That's what Renaissance art looks like. But what if you want to, as Irena, you know, taught me through her work, what if you have a notion of the self that is tied to the notion of the spirit self. You know, we are not merely our surface. You know, how do you picture a self that takes very seriously the spirit self, the animal double, for example, you know, in her work. And, but her work also, I felt, and I really don't know if you agree with this, but I also felt that what Irena, because you know, Irena has been doing self-portraits since she was in high school. And it's not for lack of material. It's because she's doing, like, amazing, in my mind, amazing investigations around what it means to represent yourself. So what does it mean? Why would I want to represent myself in a racist culture? You know? It's like, I don't like people to read me. I don't like it when people, I don't like hostile people to read me. I don't like it when people meet me and they think they know who I am and what I'm about, and they immediately start sprinkling I-I-I's in their conversation. And I don't like it. I don't like it that people think they know something about what I am when they find out that I'm Chicana. You know, so why don't I like that? Is it because I have a chip on my shoulder? No, it's because, like, we are in a racist, sexist, you know, system where I am a piece of that alphabet, even if I don't want to be. So then that's why I think we have punk, and that's why I think we have, you know, all kinds of culture styles, which are about don't read me. You don't think I'm going to scramble your reading. You know, so I feel like that what she has been doing, at least that's what it's provoked in me. Right? Because that's the interpretive process. I do not believe in art criticism or literary criticism. I think it's important. It has a place. What I think is important is that we write about how work produces, how it's a part of its moment, in whatever way we can describe that, and how it produces a certain dialogue within society. That's what is that's what cultural studies is about. And that's not another catchword, because people have been doing cultural studies in different parts, you know, in different points of history. But it happens there is a very progressive leftist born moment in intellectual history that's been going on, you know, since the 50s. And it has gotten a lot of steam in the United States, I think in the last 20 years in particular. And it has to do with understanding the culture is always embedded in its reality, it's always political. And so to look at artist stuff, for example, it really makes a difference to think about art practices as cultural practices, as practices embedded, aesthetic practices, but embedded, or artistic practices if you want, but embedded in their moment, their culture, you know, and they're inevitably political or ideological. That is to say, they engage with their world, they're political in that way. It doesn't mean vote this way, vote that way. It doesn't even mean down with racism, it just means they're engaged. You know, they're not mute or neutral. They have a political effect. Even if that is, okay, status quo, do it again. That's all a political effect. So, anyway, it's always nice, like instead one time, instead of another one said to me, you know, I really disagree with this particular interpretation, but I understand that that's you. I'm like, thank you, yeah, thank you. You know, because that's right. You know, I'm not pretending it's everybody, it's just me. And I too am situated in a specific cultural way. And I have hope that in this book that I could provide one possible set of readings that tried to take this work seriously and try to, more than anything, again, I said this in the intro, I wanted to write, I mean, I'm a writer. I wanted to write about something that mattered to me as a writer and an intellectual. I wanted to write about work that I have been dialoguing with, that has meant something to me in a deep way, and that has produced in me a set of thoughts, you know, so that it has been productive. It has been a dialogue. Like that work was born of its own conversations with culture and with other art forms. But in my view, one of the most exciting and wonderful and privileged things about art that is powerful is that it has that effect, that it prompts in us a conversation, an engagement, and a dialogue, you know? Even if it's very private, you know, and not just out there, you know, political. And so, anyway, it was a wonderful process. It was a long process. I put the book aside for a long time because one of my senior college friends, who did a review of the book, said they should publish it, but only after she does a chapter where she discusses all the theory that she read and used. Because everything, you know, that I had studied, like post-structuralism, post-colonial theory, all this theory, and I said no. But it took me a while to say no. At first, I was really pissed, and then I just put it away, and I got busy and did a lot of other stuff. And then I worked with it, and I had horrible insecurity fits, and then when I read more, you know? And then I just came back to thinking, it's my book, and I am not going to do a little exercise in subservience to all the great dead white thinkers. You know, I had an education that was its shape from the time I was undergraduate. And I learned a lot, and many of those thinkers are my allies. They're our allies. And I really respect their thought. But this was not about them, and this was not about making Chicano studies, cultural studies, you know, discussions of art, legitimated by saying, look what I know. See, I know. I know what you know, okay? So now will you let me in? No. I wouldn't do that. Because what I did do, that should have been good enough the first round, was every time I used a thought or a concept that had been developed by someone, I honored that by quoting it, or by putting the name in parentheses, or by putting a footnote, which is what we're supposed to do. You know, I mean, I tried to be honest throughout that whole process, you know? So I was not gonna invent a chapter, you know, to discuss the great white thinkers and how we can marry them to Chicano art. So, but it took me a while to come back to that because I was shaken by it because it was a dear friend. I was very pissed at her for a number of years. I'm not sure I've totally forgiven her. One day we'll have a conversation. I like her a lot though. But I just thought, God, you know, that's Eurocentrism. And it isn't to say that I can't use, of course. My book is full of the ton of insights that I've learned. I don't think that only Chicano thinkers can help us illuminate Chicano work. I think that anything can help us illuminate anything. You know, if it's interesting and useful. But, yeah, you know, I talked about being brave. Well, that's the truth. I felt really discouraged, and I had my big insecurity attack. And it took me a while. I did a lot of other stuff, working very hard, so no one would think I was being lazy, you know? And then I finally just came back and said, no, this is it. And I wrote a different introduction, but it wasn't that. It was one reading. It wasn't what they wanted. And that same person read it again later, and she had also done a lot of growing. Meanwhile, I'd been rewriting the book, rewriting it, added a chapter, and I was much happier because I didn't feel all the chapters were even the first time, you know? So I really, all these years helped me to constantly rewrite, to teach a lot, and bring it back into the book and just make it better and better. And I had to remind myself, chill, this is okay. You know, why would I want to be writing a lot of books, none of which anybody wants to read? I'd be lucky if I write one book that is like deep and you know, it's a work of serious effort. If I wrote one like that, if I write two like that, you know, I don't know what I'll do. You know, I'll be so excited. But anyway, the point is, the other thing I have to tell you, because there's graduate students here, I also had to struggle, and this was not my diss, but I also had to struggle, because I'm in the university, with other people's, like, approval thingies. You know, like, oh my God, if it's out there, what if I say something really stupid? Like, it's the stage! And I thought, oh my God, I mean, have I really read enough? Have I really worked hard enough? Am I really that smart? What if it becomes off? You know, and so that was a really important lesson for me when I finally dealt with that truth book, which was, Laura Perez, you've done your best. And yes, people are going to read it, and they're going to find faults. And you know what? Many of those faults, they're going to be exactly right. Because what you're trying to do is participate. I've come out of a community of knowledge. I didn't invent everything. I couldn't say a word if it weren't for a community of knowledge that already existed, right? Not to mention the artist. So I have this moment of humility, which is usually the problem when you're raised with all kinds of racism and insecurity. We go back and forth. You know? So I have to have my moment of true, genuine humility, which is whatever it is, if you really have done your best, put it out in the world, and trust that other people are going to build on it, are going to criticize it in a way to make the field grow, to make the field grow, and that people will, you know, just like I've tried to engage in general, the spirit of appreciation of the people I read, that those are the people that are going to read me. And if they correct me, that's what should happen, right? And so that was another thing that was holding the book back, you know, for a long time, that little ego thing, you know, it's like, is it like perfect? You know, yes, that's not perfect. It's not perfect. You know, that before it came back to me, I had no idea when it was coming back to me because it kept on changing the dates. And I was getting so tired of making all the corrections. Like if a stick'em would fall off, I was like, okay, the stick'em fell off. Where's it go? I'll find out later. So the weekend before it arrived, like a maniac, I'm sitting at my kitchen table all night long. And then I got up early the next morning and finished reading the entire book, including the footnotes. I even scanned the bibliography. I was going nuts, right? And guess what? I found a bunch of mistakes. So I said to my husband, do you think it's too late to fax them the corrections? And then the book arrived on Monday. And so like I began like with a little epigraph from Leonard Cohen, you know, about like forget your perfect doctrine. There's a crack in everything. That's how life gets it. And I thought, so you know what, you still thought you were going to have your cake and eat it too. You're going to talk about imperfection, but your book was going to have any mistakes. But that's not how it turned out. It has mistakes. So that's, you know, I wanted to share that much. I hope that wasn't like too melodramatic and too taxing on your ears and stuff, especially for those who sat through it twice. But I really did want to share that with you because, you know, you're graduate students, a lot of you here, and that's the reality of what that journey's like. And maybe the very last thing I'll say before I show you the images is that it wasn't until I decided, you know, this thing about like, well anyway, it wasn't until I decided to give myself permission to write about what I really wanted to, even though I had silence from my buddy colleagues, you know, my older buddy colleagues supposedly. It wasn't until I decided and made that leap that being a scholar became for me a much, much better thing. Because I had really felt like so like I don't think the university was invented for us, right? We're reinventing the university. So that means it's not real comfortable. It can be really, really painful on a daily basis, you know? And so especially as a woman, and especially as a woman of color, you know? And so it wasn't until I made that leap and said, I'm writing about what I want to. I'm writing about what I believe in. I'm writing about what I know is important. And if five gospels get it, cool. But that's it, that's me, you know? And when I did that, everything changed for me. It was like a muscle that I started to let grow, and I just feel like I became more real. I feel like I became more real. And it doesn't matter, I mean, it's not about do people agree with me, and do they respect the spirituality, or do they respect me, because what it did is it tapped into, it was a way for me to allow this work to happen, because it was important to me. It was important for me to write about spirituality. It was important for me to write about Chicana. It was important for me to write about Chicano community. It was important for me to write about the indigenous, the African diaspora, the hybrid to me, you know? And when I think about that, I said I want to share that because I think that what most scholars do, it is what's important to them. You know, the university in general, alias white studies versus us ethnic studies, right? Why do you think they write, you know, why is the majority of English literature like Anglo people? Because it's important to them. They need to know their history. You know? It's important. Of course, it's important to everybody to write about what is important to them as human beings. And when you read like all these great thinkers in sciences or other fields, they all arrive at the same thing at the end of their lives. They're like telling you about like how important it was for them to work on what they were, because it was inevitably, research is inevitably tied to the core of who we are. And creativity and originality, which is why people should be in academia, higher education as professors and writers, it should be a vocation, like art is a vocation. And we shouldn't be shy about that. We should give ourselves to that, if that's what we are. If we're thinkers through scholarship, right, then that's what we should do. And that means that you can't do that in the abstract. It's your own individuality and your uniqueness that has to come out. But when you do that, your originality comes out. It's inevitable, because it's what you are that no one else is, you know? And so then that becomes a way to really, not to survive, but to do work that I think is meaningful. It's truly meaningful to you. It's not just about a performance of smartness. I had a lot of projects that were about how smart I was, you know? And I thought they were politically important projects, right? But I'm telling you now that I think they were about performances of stop picking on me, I'm smart. I've done my homework. My passion wasn't in them and they didn't get done in a different way in terms of how this book took longer. And so that's what I'm saying, it's inevitable, you know, that to do this, to not be depressed, to have strength in this racist university and culture, in a Eurocentric place where it's going to be difficult to put your little proofs together, your archives, your bibliographies, if you have genuine passion for what you're doing, you'll find the ways and the creativity, and you'll have the softness from inside, and you'll have that core. So that, I think, is important to share, that it's all worth it. You know, the melodrama, if you give yourself, you know, the permission to do what your own intuition is telling you is an important project. And you may not be getting approval for a long, long time from even your buddies because they're worried about you. You're going nuts. Don't do that. Nobody cares about that. You know? But it's your life. And every day that you are studying and every day that you're a scholar, every day matters. So that's why it's important to do it as much as you can to do it your way. You know? And then when the day is done, you'll see. People will say, oh, wow, I don't agree, but I like what you said. You know? Or I do agree. You know, let me show you some of these like amazing images.